So probably to some of you, the NIH review process, it's kind of like a black hole where you send your application and you hope that you a score appears somewhere and you get money, right? So I'm hoping that I will at least attempt to illuminate the process for you. And I just want to clarify that the process I'm going to describe is the first level of review for scientific merit. It has nothing to do with the actual funding. That's another level of review, which I will also clarify in my presentation at what point that occurs. Oops. Is it going? Oh, okay. So what I'll do today is give you an overview of the review process, how assignments of applications are made, criteria for selecting reviewers, other consideration, the actual review of grant applications, how you get your summaries and summary statements and scores, because this is... I was invited by the epidemiology section. I'm going to just touch a little bit on some issues about human subjects that are recurring and sort of misunderstood and sort of everybody's misinforming everyone else about it. So I'm just going to touch on a couple of points that I just want to make, keeping in mind that the human subjects are going to be are in the process of being reviewed, so it may change eventually at some point. But at this point, I'm just going to give you an overview of... sorry, I slipped here. I went too far. It's the other way. Yeah. Okay. So what I'm going to start doing, I'm hoping that I will talk for about 45 minutes. I hope it's not too long, and then leave the rest of the time for questions and answers. I keep going the wrong way. Okay. So the National Institutes of Health comprises 26 NIH institutes and centers that fund grants. The Center for Scientific Review is one of the centers, but it's not a funding institute. What we do is review approximately 70 to 80% of the applications that come to NIH. And we primarily review the investigator-initiated applications, such as the R mechanisms, the R01s, R21s, R15s, R03s. Training grants and center grants are reviewed within the funding institutes. So we are sort of the driver of where the decisions about the merit of applications comes from. Okay. The Center for Scientific Review itself comprises... 25 integrated related groups within five divisions, neuroscience development and aging, AIDS behavioral and population sciences, basic integrative biological sciences, physiological and pathological sciences, translational and clinical sciences. My integrated review group falls under AIDS and behavioral population sciences, and we're called the Population Studies and Epidemiology Integrated Review Group. The sixth division is the Division of Receipt and Referral, which is where all the applications that come to NIH go and then are dispersed amongst all the places where they need to go for review. And I will sort of outline part of that process a little bit. So first of all, the Center for Scientific Review, as I said, is the focal point for the initial review at NIH. It serves as the central receipt point for most grant applications in the Division of Receipt and Referral. And they assign applications to CSR integrated review groups or institute scientific review groups. and it assigns applications to NIH institutes as potential funding components. So when you get your, when you submit your application, you will get a notification that says that your application has been assigned to this study section, but it also indicates to you which institute is the potential funding institute for your application. So those are the two assignments that are made. Then the Center for Scientific Review conducts the initial scientific merit review, which we call the first level of review, of most of the applications. And we have about 220 study sections going on in each particular round. So the process of submitting applications involves multiple systems working together. Already many of you are probably familiar now with grants.gov, where you submit your application, which is the federal government's single online portal to find and apply for federal grant funding, and is used by all 26 federal granting agencies. The ERA Commons is sort of the engine of the Center for Science for the NIH. And this is the NIH Electronic Research Administration system that allows applicants or grantees to electronically receive and transmit applications and award information. We also use ERA Commons for submitting critiques and also informing grantees about the merit of their application. So each system has its own registration process, as you already know, and research program people at your institution should have that information on how to register and how to do this process. So grants.gov, once you submit your application, NIH pulls applications down, checks them for compliance, and they check messages and they send warnings. And I'm sure by now you know that if you want an opportunity to correct your application, you need to submit it before the deadline. Because that window that used to be there that you could look at your application, correct it, is no longer there. So if you want that opportunity, you have to submit your application prior to the deadline so that you have an opportunity to either withdraw and submit something else or make corrections, because NIH no longer accepts additional materials after the application has been submitted. So once your application comes in, there's a two-day viewing window, but no two-day correction post-deadline. So like I said, this has to occur before the deadline if you want to make any changes. And then the application goes to receipt and referral, and within receipt and referral, I will describe the process that occurs at that point. Okay. Within receipt and referral, there are three components of assignment, and this is done by activity code, either R01, or three R21s. Most of these are assigned to CSR study sections. And they also identify where applications go by the funding opportunity to which you responded. So some funding opportunities are only through ICE Institute review, and other opportunities, those applications can come to CSR. So for example, if you applied to an RFA, some of your applications might be reviewed in an institute, and sometimes the institute has made arrangements with CSR for those applications to be reviewed in CSR. So it depends on the opportunity to which you responded where your application is reviewed. And then they also look at the institute or center that is the potential for funding your application. That assignment is made at that point, and sometimes they will assign two different or three different institutes depending on the interest and what the application is about. And then by review location, some of the applications, as I said, if they are center grants, CSR will send those to the institute where they will disperse them as they planned. Okay. Applications are assigned by referral officials. And who are these people? They are people like me who are scientific review officers, some of them. Others are just referral officers who are directors or assistant directors within the division. But for the most part, many of the referral officials are scientific review officers like me. And they also serve as scientific review officers in their own study sections as well as making referral of applications. So applications are assigned to integrated review groups based on specific review guidelines for each integrated review group. So if you go to the Center for Scientific Review website, there is a link where you can put in, what are those called? If you have specific words that you want to type in, it will bring up specific study section that might be appropriate for your application. You are also free to write when you submit your application in on your cover letter. You can request a study section, and I will tell you about how that works later on. Assignments to institutes or centers are made based on overall mission and guideline or the institute or center, or specific programmatic mandates and interests of an institute or center. So like I said, applications come into the general FOA, the parent funding opportunity announcement. Sometimes they are RFAs, sometimes they are PARs. And RFAs is a set-aside funding through an institute, and they can be reviewed in the institute or the CSR. So it just depends on what you are responding to. Okay. So once applications come to Division of Receipt and Referral, they are dispersed to the integrated review group. Within the integrated review group, the chief of the IRG, integrated review group, will make a determination which study section to which that application goes. And each of the study sections has referral guidelines that, as I said, you can find on the website and look at their description and what kind of specific scientific areas that they review. Also, an application that comes in as a resubmission will most likely go to the same study section that reviewed it previously, unless the principal investigator requests otherwise. Also, there are some considerations that are made within the IRG. If you are a member of a standing study section, your application cannot be reviewed in the study section on which you are a committee member, and therefore it goes to a member conflict. Sometimes also, if you are a PI, but you have a co-PI who is a member of a study section, that application cannot be reviewed in that study section. It goes to a special emphasis panel. And sometimes, if the study section becomes too large, you don't want to end up with too many people in the room, so that study section can be split. And most times, the split happens by mechanism, so that you have the R01s reviewed on their own and R21s perhaps reviewed in a special emphasis panel. And sometimes, the principal investigator requests a specific study section. The CSR practice is that if the request cannot be honored, you will hear from the SRO where the application goes. So as I indicated, you can go to the website, look up a study section to determine if it fits with your application, and you can request it. However, there's no guarantee that you will get it if it's not a good fit. Because sometimes people get hung up on buzzwords on a study section. And so when it gets to us, we can determine that, well, perhaps this is not the best fit, it can go elsewhere. And it's up to you as the PI, you can call the SRO and tell them that you want it to go there. But in most cases, we have a better view of where your application is most likely to get the most competent review. But that's not saying you cannot request a study section. I'm just giving you my perspective. Okay. So assignment to CSR study sections is within IRGs, is by standing study section when the subject matter of applications matches the referral guidelines of the study section, or a special emphasis panel when the subject matter does not fit into that particular study section, or the assignment of the application will go to the most appropriate conflict of interest panel. So when there are some study sections where a predominant number of members submit applications, and therefore there's a special emphasis panel specifically created for that conflict of interest panel. That's what we call it, because the members are in conflict with the standing study section. And then fellowship applications, small business applications, area grants, the R15s, are now being reviewed in special emphasis panel, because it appeared that from the enhancement of of peer review, there was the perception that perhaps some R15 applications were unfairly compared and reviewed in the same context as R01s. So at this point in time, R15 applications are being reviewed in their own study section. So assignment to an institution, as I indicated, is based on a match between the research proposed and the overall mission of the institute or center. And where applications are appropriate for more than one institute or center, dual assignments are made. As I said, the scientific merit, we call that first level of review. And CSR, or Institute Review by Scientific Review Group, is for scientific merit, and they recommend the level of support or duration, but they do not make funding decisions. So sometimes you will see on your summary statement that reviewers will suggest that the scope of work is too narrow for the budget being proposed, but they don't actually fund an application, but they will look at the application for scientific merit and appropriateness of the budget. but no funding decisions are made at that point. The second level of review happens at the NIH Institute or Center. They review the reviews, recommend funding, and then evaluate priorities or relevant of what's being proposed to the mission of the Institute. And then they advise on policy. And this is done by a board of counselors, and there are several of those in each of the institutes. So the study section. In my integrated review group, we have, in my division of AIDS, Behavioral, and Population Sciences, we have five IRGs. And within the division, my IRG is called Population Sciences and Epidemiology, and I am the Scientific Review Officer for Kidney, Nutrition, Obesity, and Diabetes, and I'm also the Acting SRO for Cardiovascular and Sleep Epidemiology. So each of the standing study section has the same SRO. Each study section has about 20 to 40 members, primarily from academia. Each study section is chartered to have at least 20 members, and then we fill gaps in expertise by looking for ad hoc reviewers who just come for that particular meeting. And they convene face-to-face meetings and sometimes virtual or electronic meetings. And we now use what we call telepresence. I don't know if you're familiar with that, where you have reviewers at different locations, but they look like in the same room. That's being instituted, but it's quite expensive, so we don't have many of those meetings. But standing study sections are usually face-to-face, and they usually review 60 to 100 applications face-to-face. So they discuss applications, and then they review all of the applications and discuss 50%, and I'll tell you the breakout later on. A scientific review officer is a doctoral-level scientist with expertise complementary to the science reviewed in that study section. And we have the legal responsibility for study section and management of the review. So our job is not to intervene on the science, but to just make sure that the review process is in accordance with policy. Okay, so before the study section, the SRO gets their list of applications for that round. So what we do now is recruit reviewers, and each application is assigned three or more reviewers, 5 to 6 weeks in advance. And reviewers assess each application by providing a preliminary overall impact score, criterion scores, and a written critique. How do we select reviewers? Well, we are hoping that some of you will contact me and say, I want to be a reviewer at NIH, and it can be for my study section or any of the NIH study sections. But you have to have demonstrated scientific expertise in your area, doctoral level education or equivalent, mature judgment, working effectively in groups, to have the breadth of expertise, to review a broad range of applications, impartiality, interest in serving, and adequate representation of minorities, geography, and so forth. So where do we find them? Once you submit an NIH application, we have you forever. We have you in our system, and so we can search our system for expertise. We also even just use Google, by the way, or any kind of source that we can find reviewers we use. Successful applicants, so for example, if you have an application reviewed in my study section and you get a good score, once you get that score, I'm emailing you to say, can you come back and review next time? Recommendations from reviewers or NIH program officials, the NIH reporter, the internet, scientific conferences, as I said. So some people are very concerned about conflict of interest. How do we determine that? What is a conflict of interest? A reviewer cannot review an application from their own institution because the assumption is that they have something to gain from the indirect expenses from that application. If it's a close family member or close friend or somebody that you work with on different committees and you feel you're so close to them, you cannot be impartial in your judgment. Long-standing scientific disagreement. This has to be something that is documented and known. Personal bias, or just the appearance of conflict. Okay. Now, some people might put on their cover sheet, well, I don't want such and such a person to review my application because we work in the same area. Well, that's not a conflict. That's actually a peer. So there has to be something beyond that you work in the same area that would preclude someone from reviewing your application. And reviewers are usually very good and sometimes even too conservative about what they say is a conflict. So we SROs help them sort of navigate to say, well, this is really not a conflict. Do you just not feel comfortable? So what I have heard from PIs is that they think that people don't disclose. In fact, there's over-disclosure of things that are not conflicts because many reviewers really would like to make sure that what they are doing is consistent with policy. So we take the issue of conflict of interest very seriously. Also, confidentiality. Before reviewers read their read applications, they have to sign a confidentiality agreement that they agree that the review that they will not use any of the materials that they read for their own purposes or share it with anyone else outside of the review process. And they are not allowed to discuss the proceedings of the review process with anyone outside of the room. And therefore, don't approach somebody that you see on a roster and you see them at a meeting and say, so how did it go? Because really, it's inappropriate for you or them to discuss the review process. Any questions that you might have about the peer review process, we are always very welcome to talk to you by email or by phone, and we are happy to answer your questions. Each study section has a chair who is usually somebody very well respected in the field, and the chair partners with the scientific review officer to conduct the meeting, guide the discussion, making sure every view is heard, and summarizes the study discussion before any scoring is made. And part of this is done so that other people who haven't read the application or not as familiar with that subject matter have a good sense of what the issues are, because everyone who is in the room has to provide a score to that application if they feel comfortable. So once reviewers have read the critiques, we get the score from the preliminary score that they enter in Commons. That score, the preliminary score, determines whether an application will be discussed or not. And generally, for new investigators, 50% of the applications are discussed. So if your application scores below 50%, it is not discussed at the meeting. So for the rest of the applications that are not new investigator or small mechanisms, 40% of the applications are discussed, which means that after the meeting is done, those discussed applications will get an overall impact score. All the other applications that are not discussed only get the criterion score and the points that are made by the reviewers. What we do is we cluster applications by mechanism. Within RO1s, we cluster those applications by new investigator or early stage investigator. The reason for this is that we would like to make sure that reviewers are comparing applications in an equitable manner so that they are not comparing a new investigator to a long-standing investigator. Plus, there are other considerations that are made for new investigators. For example, preliminary data are not as important with a new investigator because it's assumed that they are just developing their field. So what they are looking at really to make sure that this work is feasible is who is surrounding that new investigator as opposed to the preliminary data. Whereas when we are reviewing RO1s for long-standing established PIs, preliminary data is considered a lot more. Now, if you look at PHS 385, you will see that preliminary data are not required for any mechanism. It's just become practice that everybody includes preliminary data, even for R21s, but it's not required. So I just wanted to make sure you understand that. However, it's helpful. So if you don't include it, you are not penalized unless perhaps the reviewers feel that there has to be evidence to justify what you are proposing. However, you are not penalized for not having preliminary data in and of itself. However, if you do include preliminary data, it is evaluated. Okay. Yes.
To what extent is your congressional representative, either Congress or the or your senator, involved in this process?
I have never interacted with anyone in Congress about the process, no. But I believe that they are involved in terms of the funding of NIH. They are involved in terms of determining the rules for conflict of interest. But in terms of my personal interaction as SRO or other SROs, we really do not have any kind of interaction. I'm sorry?
I used to do reviews.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the best ones. They were passable, and for some reason they got funded. And I don't know what to extent that there was political impact, what the political impact was in getting those particular projects funded. There are political. I'm going to share it with you, and that there is a political process that's involved in terms of making a final decision.
As I indicated, the part of the process that I'm involved in is the scientific part, and so I wouldn't know the makings of what happens in the other process of funding. I couldn't answer to that, but as far as I know, the Scientific Board of Counselors makes the decisions about funding. To my knowledge, I don't believe that's so.
I think you're missing the step of program institute review, because at that point, the institutes, as they're getting ready to make funding recommendations to council, they're guided by the percentile scores that have emerged from the scientific review process. But they can decide that a certain area of research has a priority and recommend something for funding that has a worse score than something else that isn't as high a priority from the institute's point of view, which is very different from saying that it's guided by a political process or congressional pressure. There are priorities at the institute levels that can cause an application to leapfrog.
I have to concede and say that I would be remiss to discuss anything that involves funding, because that's my part in the peer review process is the scientific merit, and that's what I can speak to. And I don't want to venture into areas where I might misinform people about what actually happens, because I don't know. Yes. I should like to point out that Dr. Hatzok is in the National Institute of Drug and Alcohol? NIDA. So you would know about the funding process.
Yeah.
Correct. It's the science.
Right.
Right. Okay, so at the meeting, I talked about conflicts before. So any member of the panel who is in conflict with an application steps out of the room when that application is discussed, and we keep track of these conflicts very closely. So no one is going to be in the room if they are in conflict with an application. And all the assigned reviewer one is the one who introduces the application and gives the broad overview of his critique and the overall impact of what the work is proposed. And then the other reviewers add to that discussion. And after the assigned reviewers have discussed and made their points, the floor is open to discussion, and everyone who is in the room is free to join in that discussion, at the end of which the assigned reviewers will restate their scores, and sometimes the scores change as a result of the discussion, and then everyone in the room scores the application.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So are the three reviewers that are chosen, the ones in the room that are most directly have expertise in what you're presenting, or is it a random selection of those in the study section?
Oh, okay. That's an important question. So the way that I do it, I start off with the whole bunch of applications, and I have a list of reviewers and their expertise. So I start by assigning, without thinking about it, who the person I think is the most expert to review an application. And you can imagine what that does. Sometimes somebody ends up with 20. So I start playing with it to just make sure that I have people that I know are experts. But what we are also looking for in review is the big picture, because we just don't want to look at the trees, we want to look at the forest. So we always want to make sure that we have somebody assigned who has the breadth that can review for the big picture, because after all, we are looking for the impact of that work on the field. So yes, it's a very systematic way of assigning reviewers to assure that at the end of the day, the sum total of the assigned reviewers gives a complete review. So sometimes one person has expertise in one area, another in another, but together, it makes a complete and competent review. So that's how we do that. And then before the application is scored, actually, we review human subjects. And I want to add that as a person who is an epidemiologist, I'm finding that more and more people are viewing human subjects as something perfunctory and a bother. It is a very important aspect of human research to make sure that subjects in research are protected. And I'm seeing gradually over time that researchers are not spending as much time on the human subjects section of an application. And we need to make sure that we provide enough information to and justification that whatever subjects we are using in this in the research are protected from ourselves. So for your protection and for the protection of the subjects, we need to make sure that the human subject section is complete. And I will talk to you a little bit later about the human subject section. So basically, the assigned reviewers, the lowest and highest form the range, and everyone votes within that range. It's possible sometimes that some people in the room don't believe that the scores that the assigned reviewers have given are consistent with the comments, so they can vote outside of the range, higher or lower. So as long as they say what their reasons are, they are free to do that. The overall impact score is the key review outcome that reflects the reviewer's judgment of the likelihood of what impact the application is going to have in the field, the way I have described it to somebody, because people keep asking, what do you mean by overall impact score? Okay, so the way I see it is, if your application is going to get a 1 or 2, it means perhaps practice is going to change as a result of the work, or maybe some textbooks are going to be revised somewhat. Okay, and then if you get something in the middle, it means people are going to cite that work and it will create or generate hypotheses for future work. And if you don't get a good score, what I say is perhaps only your mom might cite that work. That my child did that work. But anyway, I'm just joking. But you see the gist I'm saying. Everyone wants their application to get 1 or 2. But really, a 1 or a 2 really means that there is going to be some major changes in the field as a result of that work. So discussed applications get a score on a scale of 1 to 9 from all the reviewers present. So at the end of the day, you get something that looks like between a 10 and a 90. That's what you get because we multiply that by 10. to give a priority score. And I think you have seen some restatements, some of you, where there will be an overall impact score. And an overall impact score is not an average of the criteria. It's really a gestalt of the overview of the work altogether. So sometimes you will find that an application might have high significance, but the approach is so flawed that it's not really feasible, so the overall impact score will be lower. So it's not always the case, because you get a PI emailing you and saying, but my overall impact scores look this way. But then when you look at my criterion scores are this way, but my overall impact score is another way, it really is the judgment of the reviewers, how they weight all of the five components to make the overall impact score. So it's not an average. It's really more of a weighting of what they think is most important about it, about your application. So, this is another issue that is sort of contentious lately of reviewing applications by different methods. Your applications could also be reviewed electronically, and we call this internet-assisted meetings. The reason why this system was brought up is sometimes there are other people who really can't travel, but we need them to review NIH applications. So this system was put in place to allow the breadth of reviewers to broaden without the burden of travel. So we use electronic review. I have used it many times, and in fact, in my experience, applications actually get more discussion when it's electronic, because it's over 2 days and all of the applications are being reviewed. I'm not saying it's better than the other, but I'm just addressing a concern that I have heard out there, that some people think that electronic review, people are distracted, they are not doing what they do. What I think is the problem at the end of the day is the quality of what they write and send to you. It's not the medium that's used for review. And we see that sometimes when the reviews are done, the bullets are so brief as to be informative. So if you ever become a reviewer, remember the day you get your summary statement and you look at it and you have no idea what they're saying, and try to do the same review that you would expect for yourself, because really that's what comes down to it, the quality of the review and how informative it is. And one of the problems is also if the review is not as informative, we have a lot of tied scores, so it's more difficult for program officials to really make a distinction between two applications with a tied score. It is entirely possible that there could be a score that's tied, but one application has an edge depending on the mission and the issues that the institute is looking at. So at the end of the day, I don't think it's the medium of review. It's really the quality of review. And I personally literally hound reviewers to say, edit, 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 because it's important at the end of the day to get something that's meaningful. So on our end, as SROs, we make every effort to get a quality review. But as reviewers in the future, keep in mind when you do reviews what quality of reviews you're putting out for others to look at. So we have internet-assisted meetings. We have telephone-assisted meetings, which is the good old telephone, where we have a telephone conference. Video-assisted meetings where people can see each other, but this is sort of rate-limiting after 9 reviewers because you can't see all the faces on your computer screen. And then we have the telepresence, which has the capability of making it look like you're all in the same room but in different locations. As I said, this is kind of quite expensive, so I'm not sure that we're going to see a lot more of this happening at a larger scale given the limitations in budget that we all have. So post-meeting, as I said, reviewers revise their written critiques based on the discussion and reading of colleagues' critiques. The SRO writes the resume, what you see at the top of your summary statement. Not discussed applications will receive all of the critiques and all of the criterion scores, but no overall impact or resume. The summary statement is available to investigators within 30 days of the meeting, and if you're a new investigator, you get it within 10 days. Now, the one thing I will implore you if you ever apply for an application, we always make an effort to write a letter to PIs to say, here's what's going to happen. When we say don't contact us after review, we really don't know what happens after review. So you are better off waiting for your critique. and contacting the program official who is listed on your summary statement to find out what you need to do, whether you can revise or whatever questions you have. However, before the meeting has occurred, we can answer any question about the review process. Okay, I think I've already talked about that. So this is what the summary statement looks like. And as I indicated, your program official is always listed on the top left corner of your summary statement. Your impact priority score, your percentile. Sometimes your application will not have a percentile if it's an R21 or other mechanism, because it depends on whether the institute requires it. So if it's not there, you would have to contact your program official what they think the percentile is equivalent to, because we don't know. And then if you are an early stage investigator or new investigator, it will indicate an early stage investigator or new investigator only applies to R01s. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? Yes. Okay, I'm actually going to talk about it later on, but I'll answer very briefly. Early stage investigator is somebody who is within 10 years of their terminal doctoral degree. New investigator is somebody who has never received an R01 NIH-funded application. So you could have been an associate professor in one area of research and you never got a full professor in one area of research and then change direction and start applying for NIH applications. You're considered a new investigator if you have never received an R01.
So they are the same? You know, the same.
If you have never received an R01, you're considered a new investigator, yes. This is the one time I will mention that one of the other considerations that's made at the institute level is that the pay line is different for new investigators.
Yeah.
There's a bit of padding that's put on there for new investigators, yes. This is not a cop-out, I promise you. I don't know anything about pay lines. And as I said, the only thing I will tell you is that new investigators have a concession on the pay line. But if you were to ask me what the pay line is for any given institute or how those decisions are made, I really don't know. So your best, if you know a program official, your best course is to actually call one and ask them. And if you know several institutes, if you are potentially thinking of being funded through several institutes, find out from those institutes in particular, because I really wouldn't want to misinform you on that issue. Yes?
I thought that when you submit an application, you indicated which institute you would expect it to go to.
Okay. Sometimes what happens is that you might suggest the institute you want, but that institute doesn't really want your application, or they don't think they can fund it, so they will talk to another institute and maybe do the dual funding so that both of them can consider and share burden. So that's how it happens. So the Division of Receipt and Referral will assign the institute, and then sometimes there are discussions that go on that I'm not familiar with, but that's how it happens. So sometimes you may even request an institute and you will find that it's not the one that is assigned to your application because that institute doesn't feel that your work is consistent with their mission. Yes. Okay, so for example, applications that were reviewed in May, around May, June, the decisions for funding are happening probably still happening, but they happen around October, November, September, October, November. So what's being reviewed in what was reviewed in October, decisions are made January, February, March, for example. Okay. We have standing study sections, and those are set. So we review applications. We already have preset dates sometimes when we review applications, so we wait until that date, and then we review all of the applications. So if you submit your application a month ahead, it sits until the study section. However, if you are a member of a standing study section, you can submit your application anytime. And it's reviewed on a rolling basis, but we guarantee reviewing it within 120 days of receipt. If you're lucky, we get it today. Another study section might be convening in a month, and it will be reviewed. So if you're a standing study section member, or if you have reviewed consistently for NIH over an 18-month period, you also get the continuous receipt for one round. If you have reviewed on a study section, you get a two-week extension, so that doesn't really affect. It only affects your deadline, but it doesn't affect when your application is reviewed. Okay. So I'm going through this, as I said, because there are a lot of misunderstandings about E4s in non-human subjects within the EPI, especially the EPI applications. So how do we define a human subject? Is a living individual about whom an investigator, whether professional or student conducting research, obtains data through intervention or interaction with the individual, or identifiable private information from an individual. So how do you know what kind of research it is? Is it human subject research, or is it exempt, or not human subject research? You approach it hierarchically. First, does it meet the definition that I just described before? If it doesn't meet that definition, then it's not human subject at all. So if you have not interacted with individuals or obtained private identifiable information, it's not human subject. If it meets that definition, then the next question is it exempt? And what do we mean by exempt? What we mean by exempt is, let me go here. Okay, exempt human subject research. The only types of research that apply for the most part to the kind of research that we do at NIH are research in educational settings on educational practices, educational tests, surveys, interviews, where no identifiable information or disclosure of private information, or if you are using existing data that already exists, then or specimens that you recorded in such a way that you didn't put their name and you cannot relate the data that you obtained from that specimen to a living individual. So E4 is the one that's most commonly abused by epidemiology researchers. To qualify as an E4, so I will give you an example of a typical E4. What would be an E4? Say you collected your data. Okay, you have all your specimens in the freezer. You collected them in the past. Okay, but what you want to do now is to use the blood or tissue for something else. You go into your freezer, you rip off the label that has identifiers that you can relate with a key to an individual, and just label your specimens A, B, C, D. And you don't have any means after that of linking that data to an individual, that would be an E4, okay? But it must be existing. It can't be something that you're collecting in the process and labeling like that. It must be something that was stored somewhere already existing. So do we understand what existing, what E4 is? Okay. Right. As long as there's an agreement with those people that they will never share the key with you. Okay. And as long as those people who gave it to you are not involved in your research. Yes. GIS data is very tricky. Yes.
So you may not have a date, I mean, a name, or a date, or birthday, or social security number, but you do have location. And in fact, that data is often publicly available. But I don't know how you guys classify it, if it's exempt or not.
So, okay, what we consider, if there is reasonable possibility that you can readily go back and actually say, oh, this individual, what was their, what are their genes like? Or this individual, what were the biomarkers look like? If there is no reasonable way you can actually go back and link it, then it's, it would be okay. Yeah. Well, but this one is a difficult question to answer because it depends on the context of how you have that. Yeah, so it would have to be on an individual basis to really tease apart and figure out exactly what you're doing with it. But one of the things I just wanted to say that's key is the fact that it's already existing. You don't have any way to readily link that data back, the data back to the individuals that are living. Now, if you're collecting it on dead people, and the people, if the people have died, then it's no longer human subjects at all. Okay. So the other one that's not human subjects, so E4, is that there was a time at which you had access to identifiers, but you no longer have ability to link it back. No human subjects. Okay. The information has to be collected not for the proposed research, so it has to be existing, and the investigators cannot readily ascertain the identity of subjects to whom information pertains because the key no longer exists. Or if you are using NHANES data, you are using Medicare data, any publicly publicly available data that is de-identified and decoded, that is no human subject. So remember, if, for example, someone on your team is providing you with data, you didn't collect it, but someone on your team collected it, and at some point they had access to identifiers, and they probably still do, then it's human subjects data, and you have to code it as human subjects, as long as an individual involved. But if they are just providing it to you and not involved, and by involved I mean if they are doing analysis, they are going to publish with you, anything in a scientific context, they are an involved investigator, and therefore it's human subjects. That's what I was just talking about. It's very tricky. So as long as somebody continues to have some kind of role in your work, they are considered an investigator. What we call an honest broker is, for example, if you go to the blood bank and you say, I need some blood samples, and they provide it to you, and they're not involved, it's a commercial broker or some other company, there are a lot of companies that sell tissue and so forth, then that's okay. But if it's somebody, some people who have, this is one that's most occurring, where you did a big project at your institute at one point, and then you decide you're going to use it for something else, and you're the investigator. A lot of people are coding that as no human subjects. No, it is, because you are the PI, you collected the data, you have ready means to link it, unless it happened so many years ago that you no longer have a way to link it back to the living individuals then. But it has to be clearly articulated in your human subjects section. So what I was talking about, somehow we have gotten to the point where if it's not human subjects, we don't need to include a human subjects section. What you need to do is to force the system to include a human subjects section and clearly articulate, because you will get a code 44, and if you have applied for research before and you know what a code 44 is, it means nothing goes until that's resolved. So you need to include a human subjects section regardless of what you're claiming and clearly articulate, you know, if it's E4, that nobody has a key, and all of the things that you have done to make sure that you have protected the identities of individuals. So a human subject section must be included in all of the applications, regardless of what you are claiming. In that way, it helps you because you have information in front of you and you don't get a code 44, because it takes a while to get those resolved sometimes. So you need to make sure that your human subject section, if it's human subjects, it includes all the components, the risks, the adequacy of protection against risks, potential benefits, importance, and knowledge. I mean, you don't want to give too much information, but you want to give enough information that reviewers can judge adequately that human subjects are protected. Okay, the one thing I wanted to touch on when I talked about human subjects, I actually had an application like this last time where for some reason PIs think that, oh well, I can't fit everything under the research strategy, so there are no page limits on the human subjects, so I'm going to put all my preliminary data and all the other things I couldn't fit there. Well, the first time NIH had made a decision that we'll just slap you on the wrist and tell you that you had stuff in areas that are not supposed to, where it's not supposed to be. Now, if it's deemed that it's sufficiently violating page limits, your application will actually be withdrawn from review. And that happened to a PI 2 days before the meeting. A reviewer contacted me and said there was all this information that I had actually missed, and it was withdrawn. So please, it's for equity reasons. Everybody has the same page limits. Don't try to circumvent by adding things to appendices. What I tell reviewers is if after reading your application and they notice that there are some gaps missing, and then they start flipping through the appendices and the answers come up, they shouldn't consider it at all. But now they should report it to me, and we will actually look at those appendices to see how much the violation is, and the application will not be reviewed, and you will miss a round. So it's not worth it. Let's just be consistent with the page limits. There's also the issue about what we call virtual A2s, because it used to be you could submit an application the first time, the second time, and the third time. Now you can only submit an A1. So we have what we call a virtual A2, which basically means you bring back your application after the second submission, and it's pretty much the same application, and it's sort of responding to the critiques of the prior review. There's a whole committee at CSR that looks at this application. What you need to make sure if you're going to revise your application and bring it back, there is a site on the CSR website that explains what, for your application to be considered a new application, what you have to do to change it, okay? So, in brief, this is not all of it. There's a whole section. If you're using a different model system, if you're changing the disease model, using a similar methodological approach for a substantially different question, asking a significantly different question, using a different methodological approach to address a similar issue. You can see the theme here. So, for example, if you had proposed to use MESA to look at cardiovascular, the relationship between heart attacks and, say, diet, then you propose to now use in people age 40 to 50. Then if you change the age group and you change the disease but you're using the same population, that might be okay. So you need to make sure that you talk to your program official to find out what would be considered a significant change for it to be a new application and not just in a virtual A2, because it will be returned. Okay. There are circumstances, though, when you can use the same application. So, for example, you had applied to an RFA and your application did not get a good score, but you did get the comments, and you decide, oh, I will turn around and use this application and submit an R01. That's appropriate. Okay. Or you submit an R01 and you based on the comments, you think, maybe I need to scale it back and go in back as an R21. You can do that. So there are certain instances where you can come back with the same application, but it's a different mechanism. Remember, though, once you made that change from the R01 to the R21, for example, you can't go back and then resubmit the R01. You've kind of lost that opportunity to submit it, to come back with it. So there are circumstances in which you can come back with your previously submitted application and reviewed application in a different format, in submitting the same thing, but just making sure that you address the concerns of the reviewers. Did somebody have their hand up? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I can tell you this. The application I mentioned, we had almost like 2 pages in the facilities where they were describing the population with references. That's not appropriate. If it looks like a duck and it should be in the research strategy, it should be in the research strategy. Find a way to cut back on things and put it where it's supposed to be. So you can't play around with those pages because people are looking now more carefully and there are consequences to it. So don't use appendices to say you are proposing some statistical models, but you don't have enough room to show all the models in your approach, and then you stick it in appendices. No, that's not going to fly. It needs to be in the research strategy. So maybe people are trying to play with it, but don't listen to people who are trying to beat the system, because the system will beat you at some point. You might be lucky if reviewers don't tell us, or if an SRO doesn't catch it, but it's, you know, why walk a fine line? Okay. So somebody had asked a question about early stage versus new investigator. So it only applies to R01 grant applications. And there's a specific website, if you Google NIH.com, there's a specific website that describes what that entails. New investigator is one who has not yet competed successfully for an R01 application. So it doesn't matter what your stage is in your career, as long as you have never received an NIH-funded application, R01, then you're considered a new investigator. Early stage investigator is a PI who qualifies as a new investigator and is within 10 years of completing the terminal research degree. Okay, so I want to caution you, though, as a new investigator, if you have a multiple PI application, for your application to be considered from new PI, all of those PIs have to be new PIs by this definition. So, for example, if you wanted to be multiple PI and you have yourself and another junior colleague, but you put your mentor there as a PI in the multiple PI, it's no longer a new PI application. Yes.
In your early stage investigators, are you all, a few years ago, you used to have a program to train minority scientists who were in historical black colleges to get them involved in the research process, and some of the medical schools like Meharry and Howard. This predates Morehouse. But are you all still doing that for minorities in terms of getting them involved in the process?
Okay, I don't know of any specific. I don't know of any specific CSR historically, that CSR program that did that, but what I can tell you that now we have what we call early career reviewer. Early career reviewer. The whole point is to bring in junior faculty who are productive in terms of application to come into the research, into the review process. We assign them only 2 applications because the only way you can attend a meeting is to be a reviewer. So we assign you 2 applications, you are part of the review process, and the whole point of it is that you get an inside view of what reviewers are looking like, and with the hope that it will improve your own grantsmanship. So we have an early career review. It's not limited to minorities. It's really more for junior faculty of any persuasion. The peer review process I'm talking about here is extramural review, because that's what Center for Scientific Review and all the other institutes are involved in, as an extramural. The intramural review, the intramural program is something I know nothing about. I'm part of the extramural. Extramural.
It's also important to note that about 90% of what NIH funds is done extramurally.
Right. So basically, most of NIH mission is to disperse funding for research outside of NIH. And what happens at the campus on Wisconsin Avenue is only a small part of what NIH does. Okay. So what are the benefits for being a new investigator? You have the benefit of resubmitting your application because the review process happens, and I think somebody asked a question, when you submit, is it rolling or you wait until the review? So the benefit of being an early stage or new investigator is that you can turn around and submit your application in the next cycle because the turnaround is very quick. However, I think that historically now, this has been happening, I believe, now for 3 or 4 years, and only 13% of new investigators are taking advantage of this. And there's a good reason for that, because if your application needs some substantive revision, it's better for you to kind of take your time, make sure that you have gone through the consulting process with your mentors and revise it in a way that's meaningful, because there's no reason to turn around and quickly bring it back with and then it doesn't do as well. But that, so really this is something that if your application is just on that cusp, you could turn around and have it re-reviewed. So that is one of the benefits. So summary statements for new investigators are available within 10 days so that they can turn around and submit it to the next review cycle without skipping a cycle. And the summary statement will include an explicit note that indicates the eligibility of resubmitting as a new investigator. And I think I already talked about the continuous submission for standing study section members. Not just standing study section members, but board of scientific counselors in the ICs, advisory boards, program advisory committees at NIH. So those people who are in a chartered study section to NIH service have this benefit, have this privilege to submit their application on a continuous. And then if you are a peer review, we have served as regular or temporary member 6 times in an 18-month period, you are also eligible for continuous submission. This is the other thing that is new as of September 25th, 2010. You can no longer update your application after it's submitted, and there are exceptions to this. I advise you to read the notice, and if you don't have the notice, please sign up to the listserv so that you can get in time announcements of any notices of what's going on at NIH. So basically, you can submit just a memo that says your application has been, your paper has been published, for example, but you can no longer submit preliminary data. Now, you can make some changes to your application if, for example, there was a disaster. For example, during Katrina, those PIs in those areas were given some allowances to submit their applications late, or if somebody dies. And believe me, it does happen. If a PI dies, then changes can be made after the fact in consideration of that. But for the most part, you cannot submit information after the fact. And every SRO is required to send a letter to all the PIs in their meeting, letting them know what the date is, the 30 days before the meeting within which they can send all the things that they can still send, but it's very limited. And I talked about the viewing window that has been eliminated, so you need to submit your application ahead of time if you want an opportunity to look at it and change something before the deadline. Okay, so what hasn't changed is really the same process. It's still the same. Please use ERA Commons to find out what's happening with your application. You have no idea how many times I receive an email from a PI whose application was reviewed a year ago saying, "This, I still haven't received anything. Is my application getting funded?" You have an opportunity to keep track of your applications through Commons. You should be able to know where it was assigned, when it's going to be reviewed, and when the summary statement has been released. There's no reason why somebody else should do your homework, because you should have an account where you can go in and check the process through which your application is going. Okay. So these are some of the windows that you will see when to check the status of your assignment. So for example, if you send additional material, what we do is we put the new information, if it's allowable, in your grant folder under additional materials. So if you click on there, you will actually see your additional materials in there. And it's always a good idea once you, if you send materials, it's accepted, go into your grant folder and make sure that it's in there. And if it's not, check with the SRO to say, hey, I checked my grant folder, I don't see any additional materials in there. So, if you have a good idea, and it's an important question, NIH wants to hear from you, but what you need to do is to convey very clearly what you want to do, why you want to do it, and that you can do it. So the significance, what you want to do, how you're going to do it, and that you can do it. So you have the background and experience or other co-investigators around you who can make this feasible. Convince reviewers that there's a reasonable probability that you, using your approach, your resources, and collaborators, you can do this thing that you are proposing to do. Align your goals with the funding agency's goals and missions, and communicate with NIH staff. Read the funding opportunity very carefully, because sometimes people are responding to an RFA, they make assumptions about what that RFA is based on what they know about a regular funding opportunity. So if it's a special announcement, it has its own review guidelines sometimes and on other different requirements. So you need to read each one carefully to make sure that you are doing, your application is not a waste and it doesn't get sent back. For example, to RFAs, if you send something that's not consistent with what they're asking for, they just send it back. Okay. You want to make sure you read instructions, focus on significance and impact, make it exciting, be very clear, have realistic aims and timelines, don't be too ambitious. Be brief about those things that everybody knows and be articulate about things that others don't know so that they can have a very good idea of what it is. Note the study's limitations, obtain pre-review from faculty at your institution, and proofread your application because it's very frustrating when reviewers are reading and there are all these typos in there. And humans are humans. It sort of detracts from everything else, even if it's the most fantastic idea. And you have typos, people then get annoyed with it. So, let's see. Sorry. Okay. So who can answer your questions? We are always very happy at NIH to answer your questions, but as you noticed, there are certain questions that I can answer, so you need to make sure you know who to ask, what questions, when to ask them. So before you submit your applications, you can ask a program officer at NIH or a scientific review officer. However, as a scientific review officer, I cannot really tell you. The only thing I can tell you is, yes, your specific aims are consistent with this, with what we review in our study section. I can't tell you that it's a good idea. I can't tell you anything beyond that it might be reviewed in my study section. Because what could happen is that you can show me your specific aims in abstract today, but then when you write it, it's a completely different application. So at that given point, given time point, what you send me, I can tell you it's possible. However, a program official can tell you, okay, this is not a good idea, we are not going to fund this. So know who to ask which question. And then after you submit your application and you are waiting for the review, the scientific review officer is the person to ask. The first and second of level review processes are independent. A program official really does not have input in the scientific review process. Those are supposed to be independent. So if you have a concern about your application of where it's supposed to be reviewed, don't call your program official. Call the SRO. Because the program official does not really have any input on where the application should be reviewed. Okay. And then after the review, normally people have a tendency to then say, when are we getting the scores? Well, the letter that I talked about outlines exactly when you get your scores, when you get your summary statement. Keep that in your inbox because there's nothing as frustrating as we are trying to hurry up and get this all out to you, but I'm busy sending emails and responding to phone calls about when I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, when I'm getting distracted. So just keep the email you get from the SRO if you're a PI, and that should give you all the information you need at any given point. And if in doubt, just go to the NIH website. Everything that I have talked to you about today is all on the website. The CSR website now has a lot of information about reviewer resources, applicant resources, what a review looks like. There's even a video. If you just want to get a feel for what happens, please use those resources. They are there. And as I said, everything I talked about today is all on the website, so it's available to you. Yes. Yes, it's just the multiple PI. Yes. Yes.
I assume it is something that we can release, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll think of about a way to coordinate that. Unfortunately, the epidemiology section, even though we're within APHA, we don't necessarily communicate with APHA that way. So what I'm thinking we can do is, through the epidemiology section, we can send out announcements with ways that we can distribute the slides. Okay.
But as I said, if it's not available, every single bit of this information is on the website. Mm-hmm. Yes, Dr. Hudson. Should be. Well, technically yes, but we are working under short staffing also. So yes, when I will tell you, if you call me, I will talk to you. I will do my best to be as helpful as I can. I can't speak for everyone else, but that's our role, as he said, to help you navigate the process. The program official, because you want to know whether it's consistent with their mission and so forth. So those are the people who can really advise you on that. Yes. Sorry.
What's the
I really don't have a sense, but I'm sure you're also aware of the recent publication that came up on funding. I think you might be more familiar than I am. There was a recent publication about minority investigators not doing well, regardless of where they are. So. From the What I heard from a presentation last week was that 40% of funding is going to already funded investigators. So if you are a new investigator trying to make your way, utilize the ones who are established. Yes. Actually, they tend to draw way more people because somehow there's this misnomer that there's a lot of money, and there isn't. You're better off with an R01 than going to an RFA. I recently reviewed an RFA from OBSSR. I had 120 applications in that meeting, and they were planning to fund 9. But you can come back with it as a different mechanism. That's the. No. Not if it's an RFA. If it's an RFA and it's coming back as an R01. That's okay. You can actually respond to the comments of the reviewers and submit it as a new application. Really? Okay. Okay. Yes. No, actually, that's all I know. They were talking about how 40% of the funding goes to already funded investigators. So people with money get more money. Isn't that the the reality? I'm sorry?
Well, we know that with that 40%, people who are disproportionately and historically getting those funding, if they've already been doing it, are the people which do not represent the people that are in the story. So that's the 40%. What about the other 60%?
I'm sorry, I did not catch.
Well, you said 40% goes to the ones that have typically already been funded.
Yes.
And that's another code word for people who have disproportionately and historically been able to access that.
Well, to be honest with you, this is not a conversation. My pay grade doesn't allow me to even. I'm not saying I'm not allowed, I just don't know enough about it. But what I can tell you is for those who are interested, there's a program called, for those who are, I think it's for anyone who is junior, in fact. There's a program in NHLBI. It's called the Pride Program. If you Google it, you'll see it. It's for early investigators, and you for 2 years, you are partnered. I think you have to be from a historically... actually, you can be from any institution, actually, as long as you're a minority, disabled. You can apply to it, and for 2 years, you get mentoring, and you also get support to make sure that you become an independent, independently funded. So it's called the Pride Program. It's through NHLBI. I think the Cancer Institute might have a similar kind of program. I'm not sure. The only reason I know about NHLBI is because I sit on that committee. Yes. No. All applications are looked at the same, but of course the resource part the environment component is different, so that contributes to the score, as you know. But as far as where this application is from Harvard and this application is from Morehouse, that doesn't really play a role. But I don't know human beings how they process that information. But no. Yes. Well, I'm thinking that to do that, you would have to go to a funding opportunity, and within funding opportunity, there are contact people that you can then get in touch with to ask them what you're thinking of doing. So every funding opportunity has a list of names from different institutes, in fact, not just one institute, and it will list all the contact people, and then if they can answer your question, I'm sure they will be willing to refer you to the person, to the individuals who can help you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Chinesta. I think that was an excellent presentation. Obviously, we had some very nice discussion. And if you don't mind, maybe sticking around for a few extra minutes in case people have more individualized questions that they would like Dr. Chinesta to address. So please, another round of applause. Excellent presentation. Okay. Thank you all for coming.